on Champagne Sharks. This is Trevor. You can follow the show Twitter on at Champagne Sharks. Just go to that Twitter account, Champagne Sharks, one word. But also go to patreon.com/Champagne Sharks to become a subscriber for $5 a month. You get access to double the episodes. You also get access to the Discord voice and chat server and a bunch of other goodies. And also subscribe to the Champagne Sharks YouTube channel. If you just search Champagne Sharks on YouTube, you can subscribe there as well. And we have Mario probably joining us later, but we have our guest right now, Laura Bazelon. Excuse me if I've butchered your pronunciation of your name in any way. If you could tell the guests who you are, what you're about, where to find you, and any other information that you think is pertinent?
Sure. So my name is Laura Bazelon. I am a law professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law. I direct two clinics. One is the Racial Justice Clinic and one is the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Clinic. You can find me on Twitter at Laura Bazelon. And I think I have a website still too, LauraBazelon.com.
Yeah, you definitely do have a website. Do you not run it? Does someone else,
the webmaster? I do run it, but I'm falling behind. So I haven't updated it, I think, in over a year. And that's definitely on my to-do list.
Okay. Are you still active in the New York Times?
Yeah. So I pitch them stories and it's not stories, sorry. I pitch them op-eds and from time to time they run them. So I would like to say it is hopefully an ongoing relationship.
Okay, great. Yeah, but your website is still up. It's a very classy website. It's because I was using it to do research, and it's a very easy to navigate, classy website. But I did notice that it did seem a little bit like it was not updated recently. That's why I was asking you that, because I don't think it even had all your most recent articles.
Like I know. I have to get on that. I know. I've fallen behind, and it's not updated. I confess.
Okay, great. And Mario has joined us, like I promised. So Mario, if you can say hello.
Well, hello there. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us and taking time out of what I'm sure is a very busy schedule.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk about like several things, but I figured the two things to start it off is Kamala Harris, her campaign, her history, and the idea of progressive prosecutors in general, because that's what, I mean, I think it's safe to say, I think you can agree with me, that they tried to reframe her past as being a progressive prosecutor. Is that fair to say?
It is safe to say that I will agree with you on that one, yes.
Yeah. And two things kind of came up in that, which is, one is she actually a progressive prosecutor? And the second thing is such a thing as a progressive prosecutor even possible? And those are the two things that I wanted to talk about. Mario and I have talked about this a lot. That's how this kind of came up. And I remembered I told Mario, actually, there was someone who wrote about this. In fact, she was the one whose story, if I remember right, got a lot of heat around this topic. And that's when I remembered your name. And I'm glad you joined us. But Mario, you remember that conversation, right? We were talking about?
Yes, I do. Actually, that wasn't even that long ago, huh? Yeah, we were definitely having a discussion about whether it was possible to have a progressive prosecutor and, you know, some of the things going on with the criminal justice system. And one of the things that I was curious about that was brought up in that conversation was, you know, what do we do with people that commit, you know, sometimes heinous crimes? You know, if we talk about, like, there's prison abolitionists and things like that. So, you know, there's a lot of conversation to be had about some of the, what would it look like if we, you know, have reforms that we want, or, you know, even go so far as to abolish prisons, you know?
That's a good segue, because that goes into the second topic, which is her book, Laura Bazelon's book. That's the second topic we want to talk about after progressive prosecutors, is the subject of your book. And if you don't mind just describing your book up top so people get an idea of what it's about and how it overlaps. Yeah.
So the book is called Rectify: The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. And I was inspired to write it based on an actual case I had where I represented somebody who was wrongfully convicted of murder in 1979 and spent 34 years in prison before we were able to get him out. And it really inspired me to think about what life is like afterwards, because I feel like we focus on that moment of exoneration and we want to believe that it's happily ever after for the person who's been freed, but it's a much, much more complicated story. And sometimes it seems like a real road to healing for people who've been wrongfully convicted sort of counterintuitively is connecting with the people who are on the other side of the courtroom who believe that they were guilty and even some cases testified against them.
We're going to get to that later on. I want to get back to the progressive prosecutor thing, but what made you want to write that article? Like, what was it that made you want to write an article about Kamala Harris? First of all, I never understood. Is it Kamala or Kamala? What do you guys pronounce?
It's Kamala. So just picture the word comma with L-A afterwards. So Kamala.
Yeah, I used to call her Kamala, and then the media started calling her Kamala so long, I started saying Kamala, but that just doesn't sound right at all. Yeah, I'm going to go with Kamala. Yeah, so yeah, what was it that made you feel this was something important to?
Well, I wanted to write it after she published a book that was called something to the effect of These Truths We Hold. And in that book, she spent a chapter talking about how she had been a progressive prosecutor. And because that wasn't true, I felt compelled to point out why that was not accurate and to correct the record. So that's why I wrote it.
What I like about the title of it is it's a very straightforward title. It just says, the headline is Kamala Harris was not a progressive prosecutor. Like, it was just, didn't beat the bush, just a straightforward sentence. Like, no, like, it wasn't like, was Kamala Harris a progressive prosecutor? What do we think of Kamala Harris's prosecutor record? It was just, no, Kamala Harris was not a progressive prosecutor.
What challenges, if any, did you have when you wrote that piece? I'm not certain of how popular she was at the time of the writing. You know, what was some of the feedback that you got when you wrote that piece?
So I have to start by saying I was completely unprepared for the reaction, and I think part of it was the zeitgeist because I wrote it before she'd even declared that she was running. And her book had just come out. And then she declared something like 2 days later. And a big part of her platform was that she was a progressive prosecutor. So the timing of it proved to be very explosive. And I had not anticipated the kind of attention it was going to get, nor did I anticipate that I would still be talking about it a year later. And I still am. And in fact, until she dropped out, people from the media were calling me on multiple times a week to talk to me about it. And I just had no idea when I wrote it that it would be that controversial and have that much resonance and that much staying power. And I don't think anything I've ever written in my life has done what that op-ed did.
I think the timing really helped a lot too. It hit at a time where it was a cross-section of a lot of popular topics, including a big one being representation and our, you know, bodies that are the right color or gender enough to count. In one of your articles about progressive prosecutors, well, it's not really about progressive prosecutors, but it's about like the opposite. You have an article called Innocence Deniers, which is about prosecutors who really abuse position. And there was one, Kim Worthy, who did a lot of pretty egregious stuff. And Mario, you're going to love this. The part that really jumped out at me was that you said Essence named her to its Woke 100 list. Yeah, and it's like...
the Woke 100
list. First of all, what is a Woke 100 list? It just sounds like such a ridiculous thing to create. But it's like, you know, a lot of the times, a lot of the stuff just comes because you just being there is the win. Like there's this popular joke that a lot of leftists do, which is like, we need progress, more female wardens. It reminded me of that.
Well, it's funny because I feel like it's true on both sides of the spectrum. So that article, she ended up getting a lot of the attention out of it in terms of what the media focused on when that ran. But actually, the other two people profiled were men, and one of them is a white man, and he's still in power. And in my opinion, that man, Leon Cannizzaro, who is the DA of Orleans Parish, which is New Orleans, is the most destructive, harmful DA in the United States because he has so much influence and because his policies are so awful. So in fact, I feel like being an innocence denier, it cuts across race and gender and geography. And I feel like it's kind of the same with being a progressive prosecutor. It also cuts across race, ethnicity, gender, and geography.
Can you define for me really quickly when you say innocence denier? I'm not familiar with the terminology.
I know, because I made it up. That's why.
Oh, really? You just on the fly or what?
Because it's the same thing as a Holocaust denier or sort of people who deny that the earth is round. Mm-hmm. Basically, what you do is you put incontrovertible evidence in front of someone that this person has been wrongfully convicted, either by their office or by their predecessor. And this person has the power to right that wrong. And when you present this overwhelming evidence, they turn their face away and they keep insisting in spite of all reason, irrationally doubling and tripling and quadrupling down that they're guilty.
And when you do find, when you go through all of the kicking and screaming and someone is declared innocent or something like that, is it oftentimes that they grudgingly acknowledge it? Like, is there ever an apology or anything? Or is it just largely combative throughout the entire process, have you found?
It kind of depends, but largely it's the second situation that you mentioned where they just fight till the bitter end. I mean, in my client's case, there was just no doubt that he was completely innocent. The DA fought tooth and nail, and to this day, they have never apologized, and he's been found innocent by a court, and they have never reckoned with that, and they have never actually, to my knowledge, tried to look for the person who did it. And that, I feel like, is fairly typical.
Can you think of any notable cases where that hasn't happened, where the person was very contrite or...
Yes.
Okay.
So that's the thing. I want to be fair. And there are definitely cases to the contrary. So for example, I write about this in the book, but there was this guy who was the Attorney General of Virginia, a really conservative guy. I think now, kind of amazingly, he's Trump's immigration czar. His name is Kenneth Cuccinelli II. And when I know, it's really counterintuitive. And when he was brought a case of a wrongful conviction out of Richmond, Virginia, he investigated it, became absolutely convinced that this gentleman, Thomas Haynesworth, was innocent and went to court and argued that, even with the justices berating him and saying he wasn't doing his job. Wow. So it really does run the gamut. And actually, I should give Kim Worthy her due because she has started a conviction review unit and she has been exonerating people. And I do believe that since I wrote about her, she's turned over a new leaf. And in some cases where she's freed people, she has gone to court and apologized. And Kim Fox, who's an amazing progressive prosecutor in Cook County, Chicago, she's exonerated over 24 people. She's gone to court and apologized. So it definitely happens, but those people are pretty rare.
Wasn't there some controversy I think it was Mike Huckabee when he was governor. Wasn't there some controversy with him for granting pardons to certain individuals or something like that?
My understanding of that was that he granted pardons and then I think there was a terrible result maybe where the person he granted a pardon to went out and did something awful.
Of
course, don't forget Bill Clinton, who when he was running for president rushed home to oversee the execution of Ricky Ray Rector in Arkansas, who is mentally disabled and who under current law never would be executed, just to prove that he was tough on crime. All of which to say is it's not even necessarily Republican and Democrat. Cuccinelli, obviously conservative Republican. Bill Clinton, you know, we think of him obviously as a liberal-leaning Democrat, but in the 90s, he sounded exactly the same in his tough on crime rhetoric as Bill Barr and Jeff Sessions sound today, the way that Richard Nixon sounded in the 70s. So it was just so politically risky to be anything other than hammering people that both parties really, I think, wholeheartedly participated in that.
Right. That was a bad look at the 90s for a lot of so-called liberal Democrats because they wanted to prove that they were just as tough on crime and things like that as their Republican counterparts. So I remember that very well. You know, even to this day, I have a lot of friends and family that have been obviously heavily affected by the crime bill and Joe Biden's law, you know, that whole deal. So
yes, and it's hard to get those images out of your head. Joe Biden championing some of the worst laws that we still have on the books, or Hillary Clinton promising to, quote, bring super predators to heel, which is the most racist, unscientific, insane thing to even be calling people super predators. And everybody knew who she was talking about. Yeah. And Joe Biden's criminal record, he doesn't have a criminal record as far as I know. His record on criminal justice issues is deeply problematic. And it's rooted in this tough on crime rhetoric that was really necessary to prove how tough you were, because Republicans were always saying how weak and too forgiving Democrats were.
Yeah, it's really weird.
There's a flip side to something that you mentioned that I find pretty interesting too. And that's this idea that because in a way there's a higher standard placed people of color or women who enter these positions, that they also kind of get more of the brunt of the criticism. They don't live up to it, whereas the lowered expectations on a white man is almost kind of helps, because it's like, well, he's supposed to be a scumbag or a racist, so it's not as...
I'm really glad you made that point. That's a really important point, and that's a really important point about Kamala Harris, right? Because, look, I mean, she was the first Black woman to become the district attorney in San Francisco. So she broke a huge barrier there. She was the first person of any of any gender who is African-American to become the state's attorney general. And those are just huge leaps in terms of the amount of people she had to convince. California, despite her reputation, is a really diverse state. And we've got a lot of people who have strong views about criminal justice that are not liberal. And so she had to put together a coalition to win. She absolutely did. And I think she probably had to try harder than a white guy. I think that's fair.
An interesting conundrum that happened to me was that some people took that valid concern, which is, hey, she kind of has to be, people are being extra hard on her for typical white guy behavior, and instead use that as a defense. So you started getting a lot of boosters being like, hey, of course she has to be as bad. It's racist to expect her to be better than the white guy, social justice, which became like a weird, bizarre argument, where it actually was the woke thing to do is to give her the freedom to be as awful as a white man.
I feel like we are tumbling down a rabbit hole right now, but there is some, it's sort of crazy. And I guess I feel like I wasn't holding her to the standard of a white man. I was holding her to the standard of a progressive prosecutor because that's what she was saying she was. And so I was taking her at her word, and then I was saying that I didn't agree with her characterization of herself. And then I gave kind of what I thought was an evidence-based case, because I'm a lawyer and I like evidence, to back up what I was saying. And so there's kind of two points here. One is there are certain things that are associated with being a progressive prosecutor that you do, and she didn't do any of them. The second thing is it fair to her because as a Black woman, she had to overcome so much more skepticism than a white guy because of implicit and explicit racial bias? And both things I think can be true. In other words, she was up against way more obstacles, and she shouldn't call herself a progressive prosecutor. She should have just run as a centrist prosecutor, as a pragmatic prosecutor. Use whatever word you want, but don't use a label that doesn't fit and that means a really specific thing where your record is completely opposite.
And I think it's fine to point out that she had a double standard and there was an expectation for her to kind of show she was tough without going so far as to say it's unwoke to point that out, or it's she should be celebrated for it, which was like a weird way people were going. I mean, similar thing kind of happened with Obama, where some people were almost saying, like, you know, he had to be as tough, and we should actually praise him for showing he could be as ruthless as a white guy in certain scenarios. Like, I heard some people say that about the drone strikes that he was doing, and yeah, the deporter in chief. That exactly. That's another example. But I don't want to assume. But based on your picture, I would assume you're white.
I am a white lady. It's true.
Okay. No, I want to make sure. I don't want to. So,
and I think some of the blowback was because of my race. And I think a lot of people felt like, well, who am I to really point that out? And I think that was where some of the blowback came from. And it was funny. I mean, not funny, but there were kind of a couple reactions. There were all the people that blocked me who I couldn't communicate with. And there would be people who reached out to me and would say, have you read this thread on Twitter? And I would be like, no, they blocked me. And then I would have a conversation with that person where they would say, I'm really hurt and upset about what you've done and what you wrote. And I feel like it was racist. And then I would say to them, okay, well, let's have a conversation. And we would sit down and have a conversation. And they couldn't refute anything that I was saying. It's not like the New York Times printed a long retraction. Oh, Laura Bazelon misled you about Kamala Harris's record. Everything I said was true. So you're sort of stuck with these facts, and then you're stuck with the fact that I'm white. And I guess I'm just not really sure how that adds up to me being a racist, particularly when you look at what I've been doing my entire adult life.
It's weird, this expectation that you're supposed to safeguard the reader's feelings. Like I understand not being deliberately incendiary or offensive, but this, I mean, because that happens a lot too, where someone objects to something that we say on the show or on Twitter, and they kind of say, like, you know, it hurt me, but it's
a hard really, truth or something like that.
Or even not a hard truth, because, you know, maybe it's not true. Maybe we're wrong, but it's not something that we did with just being offensive. Like, hey, let's shout a slur. Like, we just make an argument they don't like and back it with evidence. But
it's tough to make these arguments. And I think it's really tough when you're on the left and you're embedded in the left. And that's how I've always thought about myself, is so far left. And then because of the community we live in, which is very self-critical and maybe rightly so, but it's easy to get on the wrong side of a lot of folks and have blowback.
Get caught up in that cancel culture, huh, Laura?
Yes, I think so, right? I mean, I feel like, you know, you say things. I mean, well, so just to go back to this op-ed for a second and then we can move on. But so many people, especially in California, who are very familiar with her record, would say to me, I'm so glad you wrote that. Thank God you said that. Someone had to say that. But I would never say that. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's why pretty much anything I write gets published, because I say things other people are thinking but don't want to say.
Okay, gotcha.
So do you want to give some examples of some of the more egregious stuff that you felt had to be brought up in response to Kamala Harris's claims of being a progressive prosecutor?
There are a number of things. The thing that kills me, because I'm an innocence advocate, is this case involving a guy named George Gage. And he was convicted in 1999. He's African-American, repeatedly sexually assaulting his stepdaughter, Marion. And the case was brought 5 years after he saw Marion for the last time because her mom got a divorce and moved away. And so these allegations were old and they were not corroborated by anything other than Marion's word. And there was all of this stuff going on in the background. They had this very acrimonious divorce. George had cheated on Wanda with another woman. She had run up his credit card bills. There had been all this drama back and forth. Mm. And in any event, Wanda sort of encourages Marion, her daughter, to come forward with these allegations. And George gets prosecuted in LA. And it pretty much comes down to Marion's word. And in the first trial, the jury hung. They couldn't make a decision. And George, who had no criminal record and I think was in his 60s, was offered something like probation by this prosecutor and turned it down and said, I'm not a sexual predator. I didn't molest anybody. I'm not a criminal. And then went to trial again and was convicted and was sentenced to 70 years to life at the age of 60. And it turned out that this prosecutor, Christopher Estes, who is now a judge, was running for judge the whole time. And he was elected 3 days later. And he held back reams of evidence of Marion's records that showed all kinds of things, including just repeated false and misleading statements that called into question her credibility. But the most damning thing was that she had been admitted for psychiatric treatment and her mother, Wanda, had written on the intake form, my daughter is a pathological liar and she lives her lies.
Oh my goodness.
And the jury never heard any of that. It came to light at sentencing and the trial judge reversed George's conviction because she was so outraged. The Court of Appeals, and this is such a crazy legal thing, reversed and said, the jury never heard it, and so you can't grant a new trial based on something that the jury never heard. So 10 years later, it filters up to federal level, and Kamala Harris is tasked with deciding what to do. Is she going to defend this conviction, which is so tainted and so illegally gotten? And she went to court and had her deputy, not her, but had her deputy get up there and say that this conviction was okay, that what had happened was okay. And not just that, but because George Gage had been forced to be his own lawyer, because at that stage of the proceedings, you don't get a lawyer, and he was half blind and poor. He had failed to frame the issue in exactly the right way. And so technically, the federal court couldn't hear the case on the merits, and they just had to deny it because he hadn't raised it in exactly the right way. So when this deputy made this argument, these judges were pretty outraged, including the presiding judge, who's a Republican. And they kept saying the duty of a prosecutor is to seek justice, not to convict. Do you really want to do this? Do you really want to do this? And then they sent the parties to mediation, which was the sign, drop this case. This case is bad. And they just doubled and tripled down, insisted that they were not going to let it go. And the Ninth Circuit, ultimately the court, found that they didn't have the power because of this technicality to right the wrong. And so George Gage is still in prison where unless the governor intervenes, he's going to die. So to me, that's the worst one because it's just so horrible and it's so obvious what the right thing to do was. So that one just sort of kills me. But then there's sort of the more policy-based things. Like, so for example, the Black Legislative Caucus here in California, very progressive, and our legislature actually totally is very progressive. We have super majorities in the Assembly and the Senate, Democrat majorities, but they really wanted, when she was AG, to pass some legislation mandating the use of body cameras and also transferring investigations of officer-involved shootings away from the local DA to the AG, because obviously they're going to be less biased then and less likely to result in what always happens, which is no police officers getting charged. And she didn't support either bill. And that disappointed not just regular progressives, but the BLC, who had really counted on her being supportive in that context. And then just sort of this list that I could go on and talk about, but just all at every juncture where there's a progressive position and a safe center position, she took the safe lane and didn't do the right thing. And so that was what was so disappointing.
And at some point, at certain times, seems like even at risk of alienating her base or those who purport to be her base, you know, like if you say that leftists and African-Americans, minorities and things like that are your base and these types of policies come your way and you have a chance to affect change in that direction and you don't do it, especially she did the body cam thing in the height of the whole, the police shootings and Black Lives Matters and everything else. And, you know, she still.
But that raises a good question. Yeah. Did she consider them her base? Because one thing about California, I don't have to tell you, Mario, because you live there, but it's like New York in that a lot of people think it's a very liberal state.
Right.
But in actuality, it's just one or two blue cities or three blue cities in a
with huge populations,
a huge sea of quote unquote rednecks and stuff. People be surprised how redneck
I was going to bring that up because California is like that. The large cities, of course, have, you know, the blue. Los Angeles, San Francisco, a couple of different areas, you know, closer to the water. And then, but all of the inland, you know, Fresno County going up north, going back down towards, you know, the border, things like that. Some parts of San Diego, a lot of red down in that, in California.
The OC,
yeah.
Bakersfield, yeah. Tulare County,
yeah.
Humboldt. Yeah. I mean, I had a case in Humboldt and it's the only time I've ever been to court where the majority of the defendants were white.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, but which just, I mean, I don't even know what to say about that. But yes, you're absolutely right. That's true. And the other thing that's true, I feel like, is, okay, where are people like me going to go? If our choice is Kamala Harris or Steve Cooley, who's the person she ran against, I think, the first time, we're not going to vote for Steve Cooley. Mm-hmm. So there's only one place to go. And so I think in a way, if you're the most left person, you can kind of take those folks for granted. And what you really want is the center.
Yeah.
And the cops, because it really helps to get the support of the police union.
And she didn't have them the first time she ran for AG, and she won by less than 1% of the vote. And she had them the second time, and it was just a landslide. Oh,
so and it makes a difference. Yeah, I can imagine from the first time not having their support, the second time having their support, I think goes a long way and probably explains a lot of what was on her mind with these calculations, you know?
Mm. Yep, that's right. Absolutely. That's all true.
Yeah, given that, and also, you know, this is a true fact of the matter is, you know, the African American population in the state of California has shrank drastically over the last, you know, 15, 20 years or so. You know, people have been, a lot of Black people have been leaving the state of California. So, you know, what would have been a pretty reliable block for her as well, you know, has dwindled to almost nothing in this state. So, you know, I guess you have to factor that into it as well.
And that was true when she was running for DA, because the population of people who are Black who live in San Francisco has been dramatically declining. I think it's less than 4% now, which is shocking and shameful.
Oh, it's crazy. Like, I visited there twice in a couple of years, and just with your naked eye, you can visibly see the difference a couple of years just walking around San Francisco. It's kind of alarming, honestly. Yeah, one thing that I'm interesting about this article was that when I first heard about how bad she was as a prosecutor, before reading your article, I had heard about it before, but I kind of filled in my own blanks, and I imagined it more of like an implicit bias thing or just being a little bit overzealous and as a result being careless or not being willing to kind of listen to evidence or whatever. But a lot of the stuff you describe is actually very calculated. Like, no, it wasn't a matter of like somebody gives you a folder and you just push it away. Like, not now, you know, busy. It's not like that. It's like, okay, we know about all this stuff. How can we actively quash, get it thrown out or get it ignored or actively go against it? Like the fact that you bring up one thing went all the way to mediation, which is pretty clear a signal that there's a lot of problems with it. So it's almost like a villain in a movie kind of thing, some of this stuff. It's not, because I think a lot of defenders are just trying to make it seem like, hey, she was just doing the best job she could and she got a little carried away in her zeal, you know? And
I mean, I think the other thing that bothers me about George Gage is that there was this parallel case coming up at the same time, almost in the same situation, where it was a different guy. His name's Johnny Baca. And he was also wrongfully convicted of a murder, the difference, it was the same situation in that he was convicted in LA, he was convicted in state court, you know, she had nothing to do with that prosecution. It was also problematic because the prosecution used perjured testimony, not just from the snitch in jail, but actually they put a prosecutor on the stand who also lied to convict this guy. And it came up to the Ninth Circuit, and Kamala Harris's office, her deputy, came in and he started to defend it. And the judge, who was the panel, head of the panel, was this very famous judge who, when he talked about things like prosecutorial misconduct, made a lot of waves. And the judge just went after this deputy and he kept saying, you better go back to the Attorney General Kamala Harris, not your supervisor, Kamala Harris, and tell her we are concerned about this conviction and that we are going to write an opinion. I don't know if she wants her name to be on it or your name to be on it, but you better go back and talk to her. And after that, she dropped it. And it was weird. It was the same year. It was 2015. And quite frankly, in my opinion, the evidence showing that George Gage is innocent was much more compelling than the evidence that Johnny Baca was innocent. The difference was the amount of public attention that they got. Johnny Baca's video of the oral argument, because the Ninth Circuit live streams, it went viral by law professor nerd standards in that, you know, 40,000 people watched it and it was covered by the media and it was a big deal. People were using that to teach 1L students about prosecutorial misconduct, right? And so it was embarrassing and she backtracked. But George Gage, he didn't have a celebrity judge and not that many people watched that argument. And so it was just easier to kind of walk away. And it seemed to me, at least, like it was a real political calculation. I couldn't figure out how else to reconcile them because like I said, it's just much more obvious that George Gage was truly innocent.
And that's something that's crazy, that it was in 1L cases as like example of misconduct.
It's a famous oral argument. And I mean, your listeners should watch it. You can just go on YouTube, write down, just type in Ninth Circuit Johnny Baca, it'll pop up. It's pretty riveting stuff, even for non-lawyers, just because like you don't see judges and attorneys go at it in that kind of a dramatic way. And they just, these judges were not having it because they kept saying, this is wrong. You're relying on lies. You're cheating. How can you stand up here and say that to our face? Go back and talk to your boss.
Something I always wonder, actually, Mario, were you going to ask a question?
No, you got it. Go ahead.
Okay. Something I always wonder, there's two things. First, I always wonder how much of this kind of stuff, somebody doing something that's based on some kind of core value that's guiding them, how much of this is based some versus doing this just based on, I don't care what's true or false, I just need a result. Like say, for example, I need to get the police on my side. And some people say, well, what does that really matter as long as the result is the same, which is, you know, negative. Like who cares that she really has some kind of deep burning desire to just stomp on criminals, whether it's, you know, motivated like racially, class, whatever, versus whether she's just doing it just because she wants to become president one day and this is expedient. But it's something I always like wonder. Like, for example, with Bill Clinton, he always struck me as someone who kind of didn't have core values. So to him, doing that thing with the death row inmate,
whichever the he wasn't the like one of these. Blowing.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't even have like a core value guiding him. He wasn't even going against the core value. It wasn't like he's like, I believe one thing, but I'm going to do the opposite against my beliefs. I feel like he just inside, he's the same either way, you know? And with Kamala, and this kind of requires you maybe to psychoanalyze, so it's not a fair question, but it's just something that always kind of, I wonder when I look at these kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, I never like to say or speculate that people act vindictively or people are bad people. I think it's much more likely that the explanation is, I'm really busy, I'm overseeing a lot of cases and a lot's going on, and I'm going to leave it to these senior people to sort it out. And I have my areas that I'm interested in, and then my areas where I'm just really going to delegate and not pay that much attention. And I feel like that's kind of the default for a lot of people who are in power, plus the political calculus of, is it worth my spending down this political capital to do the right thing? And then they do this calculation and come up with a result.
And all the while they have people's lives in their hands and, you know, they're playing that sort of political chess with. It's really, that really kind of takes me off.
It should. I feel like it should tick off more people. I was very surprised how many people wanted to sweep this under the rug. A lot of people are straight up saying, like online, don't read this piece. Or, you know,
I understand, because it's like, well, Donald Trump is in the White House right now. I mean, we have gone from Barack Obama to Donald Trump, right? And so why are we having this argument? I totally, on some level, I understand that impulse. But the truth is the truth. And so if you're looking away, you're just choosing not to see it.
But I also think Obama had a role to play in this, because I think a lot of people were just kind of afraid of electing another empty suit that just had the right optics.
I feel like, he was a very substantive person. And I mean, especially God by comparison, but I think he's an amazing human being. And I think he did an admirable job under incredibly harsh and unbelievably racist circumstances. And I do feel like it was so much easier to be critical of him before 2016. And now I dream about him coming back, or I don't know, Michelle Obama running, you know, it just, the fact that we've fallen that far, that we've gone so far to the other side, that our reaction as a society to electing a black man was to elect the most racist, corrupt individual is depressing, profoundly depressing to me.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that, God, this probably would take us in a whole different direction, but just kind of running with what you had just mentioned, there are those who would say, you know, when you look at the harm that was done under President Obama, you know, when you talk about drone strikes, things that have to do with immigration, things of that sort, his total lack of activity with regards to some of the horrible things that we saw going on with police across the country during his tenure as president. Some people would say, you know, what's the big difference between him and a Donald Trump being in office, as opposed to, you know, of course, he's a more personable guy, and he certainly was he had an air of dignity about himself that Trump totally lacks. But some people would just say, hey, look, when you compare the harm that's been done and you look at it very closely, what's really the big difference between the two?
Wait, can I add a qualifier to your question?
Go ahead, yeah.
I would ask, what's the big difference, black people? Because I think for people who aren't black, there is a difference, because he's kind of turning everyone else into a black person right now, which I think is what's scaring everybody. But
that is such an interesting way of putting it. I've never heard it put that way. So interesting.
Yeah, because I think for black people, under Obama versus Trump, Obama was ignoring us the same way as Trump was. Like, people say Trump is so bad for black people, but I mean, yeah, he's very rude and crude toward black people. But as far as actual policies, I mean, he's just neglecting us the same way Obama was. Obama really didn't really do anything specifically for black people. Anything he did for black people was lift all boats.
I was just about to say a rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah, that was what Obama did.
And then when he did reference, you know, specific things, it was in a very condescending kind of tone. I saw his CBC scolded, speech, like, for example.
Yeah.
You know, really.
Yeah. I just wanted to add that qualifier to your question, Mario.
Oh, perfect. Good, man. Thank you.
Specifically for black people, how is Trump worse is what?
Well, what about, I mean, so there's issues like climate justice that affect all of us, right? I mean, if this planet overheats, none of us can live here anymore. I don't care what race you are. And Donald Trump thinks that climate change is a hoax and pulled us out of the Paris Accords. Now, I realize it isn't on its face a racial issue, except that it applies to every single race, ethnicity, gender on the entire planet. And we're cooking slowly, except now it's being accelerated by a climate change denier. So just even that one issue, I realize you can say, well, that affects everyone. That's true. And it's also true that it affects everyone, right? So just on that one issue, and I'm not even an expert at all in that area. And in fact, I find it hard to read about because I get so depressed. I want to stop reading. But just in that one area, right? But was Obama perfect? No. Did Obama go out of his way to be like, I am going to help black people? No. And I think part of that was because he was black, everyone assumed that was what he was going to do. And so he was just getting hit so hard, so constantly from the right. I mean, I don't want to speculate about his mental state, but it kind of seems like from the get-go, it was like, how can we get this guy to fail as soon as possible and eviscerate him, right? It definitely seemed that way from the get-go, that he was up against not just the standard opposition to a Democrat, but also opposition to the fact that a black man was in the White House.
And that's part of the frustration that you find in a significant and vocal portion of the black voting black man, is that it's very easy, seems like, for you mentioned those concerns, and it seems like it's very easy for the politicians to do that calculus, like, you know, if I get in here, I'm not going to be able to do anything for my people. So, you know, like, okay, going to take that out of the calculus already, you know, and we're not even giving it a significant try.
I'll say something else about Obama that frustrates me is that even though I'm not crazy about how he was for Black people, he put Black people on the back burner too much. And for example, the way he spoke about trans back with such vigor and force, and he called it the new Jim Crow, the new civil rights. And I have no problem him advocating for that. He could never bring himself to be that unequivocal for Black rights, you know. He had to be very measured. But part of me understood why as well, that he had to kind of balance that because of the racism. But it puts me in a weird position, because even though I didn't like a lot of what he did for Black people, the fact that I knew so many people disliked him just because he was Black put me in a position a lot of times to default defend him. You know what I'm saying?
And I feel like I would feel the same way if we ever elect a Jewish president, where, because I'm Jewish and I'm pretty sensitive to that. And if people would hypothetically make anti-Semitic comments, I would feel this immediate visceral need to defend the person, regardless of whether I like them or not.
Yeah, and Obama kind of put me in that position, because I'm convinced that this is my particular, I don't even think this is a conscious mental calculus that people were doing, but I remember when I used to listen to like different conservative talk radio or reconservative articles, because I like to, you know, see what everybody's saying. A big thing that was happening on forums and conservative talk radio was the kind of thing where it's like, oh, once Obama wins, you know, he's incompetent. And a lot of people would either say explicitly or imply, you know, because he's Black, he's going to screw up. Even though I didn't like him, I'm like, I don't want that to happen, right? And for all my complaints about Obama, I will say he was a competent president. He was very statesmanlike. He could handle the job of being president. He even though I didn't like the choices that he made in his policies, he did everything competently. He didn't embarrass the country or whatever. And I think that messed up a lot of his critics, because, and this is like something that was really said. I listened to this particularly terrible guy, Michael Savage. I listened to him talk about Obama, and he was saying, oh my God, when Obama wins, he's going to have people playing dominoes on the front lawn of the White House.
Yeah, old he's men. That guy, Michael
yeah,
Savage.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. There's going to be old men in chancletas playing dominoes, 40 ounces on the front lawn. There's going to be a hoopty broken down on the White House lawn. He was saying like all types of crazy stuff. And he wasn't like just being funny. To a certain degree, he really thought it was going to look like a third world African palace or a South American dictator, you know, and whatever. And when that didn't happen, it kind of ruined a lot of the expectations. Like, okay, the Black guy didn't blow up the country or, you know, do whatever. He didn't like let it go down. So I think the next thing they did in their mental calculus is, he can do the job. We have to convince the world the job is bullshit. So let's find the most incompetent, fucked up white person to put in there.
Theory, it makes so much sense. Because I think Obama was beyond competent. Obama is one of the smartest, most accomplished people I have ever seen in my entire life. I mean, the man is brilliant. He can sing beautifully. He has an amazing family. He gives a speech like I've never heard before. He's totally substantive. I mean, talk about wiping away all of the stereotypes that people like Michael Savage were peddling. He mopped the floor with those people.
Yeah, and I will give him credit for that. He was exceedingly competent. He was very intelligent and stuff. So I think they had to devalue the whole institution of the presidency. Like, you know, if you can't prove Obama isn't shit, then we're going to prove the job isn't shit.
It's so such a good point. I love that you said that. It's a great theory, and it explains a lot, actually.
That is hilarious.
I love that you said that.
Something I found interesting was that you went back to the well after Kamala pulled out, and did people view this as twisting the knife? Because you put, you wrote a second article.
Can I do a tie into my book at this point to explain myself? Can I hawk my book at this point to explain? Okay, I'm going to do a little jujitsu move. My point is, look, if you are willing, and I've said this all along, if you're willing to count for what you have done and reckon with your past and acknowledge the harm and promise to do better in a restorative justice way, that's awesome. I'm done criticizing you. And so if she had just said, I made a mistake, and you know what? I'm going to call Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, tomorrow, and I'm going to tell him, Gavin, you need to grant George Gage clemency immediately. And I'm going to say, you know what? I made a mistake when I didn't support these bills. Or I made a mistake when I laughed when I was asked whether marijuana should be legal. I'm fine. But the response was just so lame. It was, she didn't have anything substantive to say. So she would just kind of revert to these empty talking points. You know, I was the most progressive prosecutor ever. And that's just really, really disappointing. So I feel like if you're willing to meet me halfway, I will meet you halfway. And then we're done.
Yeah, she definitely walked it off. She did not take anything back.
I don't think she learned from it at all. Kamala Harris is supposed to meet me, some random law professor, halfway. I don't mean me personally. I don't mean like she's supposed to sit down with me. I just mean
she cares about me.
She, I mean, just publicly acknowledge that this is a valid criticism and respond to it on the merits. That's all I wanted, but it never happened. And so I feel like part of why maybe, and you guys can disagree with me, maybe you think I'm wrong about this, but I feel like part of why she didn't catch fire, even though initially she really did, was there was this sense of, who is she? I don't know who she is.
Yeah, inauthenticity. And you bring that up in the article. And there was a good quote that you had from her that I think she meant it one way, but it ended up ironically being her problem in a different way. And the quote was, Harris is famous for repeating the advice, don't let people tell them who you are, you tell them who you are. And I know how she meant it, but I think that was a problem. She thought she could just tell people who she was. People have no right to look at the evidence and say, no, you seem to be this other person.
Yeah, because you kind of have to show people who you are, particularly when you have power. It's not enough to just talk some fancy political rhetoric and hope that that does the trick. You have to actually do stuff. That's hard to do and somewhat risky to stand up for what you believe in.
And it's even worse when what you actually have done or have shown is the opposite of what you're saying.
Right. And so that's kind of what motivated me to do it in the first place. But it wasn't out of a place of trying to be vindictive or bring another woman down or anything like that. It was more just, I think it's really important when you have power to use it in a way that is going to align with progressive values. Not just say you're progressive, but actually do the progressive thing.
Yeah. So you're saying the second one was not just pouring salt in the wound or kicking.
I think my point was just, I wish it had gone down different, right? Not sort of doing a dance in the end zone, but more just, I wish this hadn't ended this way. I wish that the response had been different and more along the lines of what I was saying I wanted, rather than just kind of hoping that the whole thing would go away when it was never going to go away.
I wanted to kind of move into this topic really quickly of criminal justice reform. Where do you see that now? Like, what would you like to see? What are you seeing being implemented, if anything at all? And is it kind of superficial? Because I think I saw this thing where they did this bail reform in the state of California, and I'll be quite honest with you, I don't understand it. It seems relatively superficial just on a glance.
This is a really important issue, and I'm going to try to do this in a way that is not boring. So, okay, we just had an election in San Francisco where we elected a DA who I think is the most progressive DA in the United States. And his name is
Is this the election you were just talking to me about?
Yeah. This is okay, the election. Good. So this guy, Chayza Boudin, his parents were convicted of a very, very serious crime in which three people died. And his dad is still in prison. His dad is probably going to die in prison. He was 18 months old. They left him with a babysitter and they never came back. So he grew up visiting his parents in prison, he was adopted by other people. And he has really kind of like a lot of unique insight into the system. And he is a lifelong public defender. So before he ran, he had never prosecuted anybody. He'd never been a prosecutor. And he came straight from the public defender. And the fact that he won is just almost nothing short of a miracle, even in San Francisco, because the whole machine was lined up against him. But one of his big issues is he doesn't believe in money bail because it criminalizes poverty. So I can just like give you an example. If you're rich and guilty and you're accused of murdering someone in California, you can buy your way out under the money bail system because we have an amount that's pegged to a murder charge. And if you can make that amount, you're out. And if you're an innocent person charged with a much less serious offense and you're in jail, but you can't post bond, you're just going to stay there.
I actually saw something like that. There was a case up there where there was a lady that was accused of killing the father of her child. And the bail was insane. It was something like $1.5 million or something. And she was able to raise it because her parents were rich. You know, I think she came from a Chinese family and they had a lot of money up there. And she was able to buy her way out. And I think she eventually was exonerated in that case, too. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
No. But it's really interesting, right? Because it doesn't depend on it. All it depends on is how much money you have. That's how our system operates in California. It's like, can you pay this amount? Yes or no? If not, you can stay in. If yes, you can get out. And that's just kind of a crazy way to be dealing with people's liberty. But that's how we do it. And Chayza has always been against that. And so he filed a number of lawsuits. One of them is now in the California Supreme Court, basically saying it's just unconstitutional to criminalize poverty. So when he won, he said, I ran this platform, I'm eliminating money bail. And a couple of days ago, he eliminated it. So we don't have it anymore in San Francisco. Now, that's one DA in one county, a big county, but one DA, right? So then you've got the rest of the state. So you were talking about the legislation SB 10, which was passed in 2019 by the legislature. And that was supposed to do away with money bail. And it did, but it also really made a lot of progressives upset because it kind of replaced it with this idea that we're going to basically lean towards detaining people almost no matter what in the vast majority of cases, which is, of course, not what you want. It's like, okay, you're just replacing one bad system for another one where they're not even getting bail that they can't make. They're just getting detained. So that legislation went into effect. And then the bail bonds people who hate it because they make all this money off of money bail, they sued. And then the people on the left aren't excited about it, so they're not defending it. And so now there's a referendum on the ballot to do away with SB 10. And we'll see what happens in 2020. And then the third thing that's happening is what the lawsuit that Chayza Boudin was involved in, which is now in front of the California Supreme Court. So then they have to decide what limits are they going to set? How wide is the net going to be? Who can we detain under what circumstances and what kind of process are they entitled to? So those three things are all happening kind of at the same time. And what's interesting, because you guys were asking me like at the outset of this, well, what difference does it really make? And is there such a thing as a progressive prosecutor? And here's an example of a difference, right? Because the California Supreme Court could decide tomorrow, detain anybody you want. Money bail is fine. And our local DA in San Francisco is not going to do it because he has the power to decide. He's going to be like, you know what? I could do this, but I am choosing not to. And that's when it really matters who's in power.
And Chayza Boudin is someone who already won, right? Not somebody who's running.
That's right. He won in this election that we had in November. And, you know, it was a little bit of an earthquake here in San Francisco.
And Mario found that her bail was $35 million. Mario just sent me that. It was pretty high.
Right. But again, you know, if you're Tom Steyer or the founder of Google, there's no bail that's too high. You can pay it. You can pay it.
And especially in the Bay Area, I saw so many rich Silicon Valley dudes. Like, there's a lot of people there who could pay that. Yeah.
Guilty as sin and pay it and get out. And here's the other thing that's super, super crazy about this money bail thing. So you could be a super rich Silicon Valley bro. You could be charged with attempted murder of your girlfriend. The bail set at $1 million. You post it, no problem. You get out, you kill her. They're not going to revoke your bail. Now, you'll get arrested for murder, but you won't actually forfeit your bond. Isn't that just unbelievable? So there's no incentive not to commit a new crime because there is, obviously, because you don't want to go to jail, but there's no financial incentive. We won't take away your bond.
I'm waiting for like the first tech bro, like Silicon Valley, like serial killer to happen. And then
I don't think you have to wait long.
Yeah. And then have him say he was just disrupting lives. He was just,
That's what the defense is going to be like. I'm all about disruption.
Yeah, exactly. I was just disrupting his lifespan. That's definitely going to happen. But I want to close out this topic. Your Innocence Denier article already has a list of various bad prosecutors, Kim Worthy, Michael Ramos, Leon Cannizzaro. So people can just kind of read that. So instead of asking you to just regurgitate this article, I wanted to ask if you had any other positive examples of progressive prosecutors you wanted to bring up.
Yes, I have so many. Okay, so yes. So we talked earlier about Kim Fox. She's the prosecutor for Cook County, Chicago, which is notoriously corrupt, racist, and horrible. She's this amazing woman. She's a former prosecutor. She's just done so much to reform the system. I met her personally. She's the most lovely person. And she's doing it in the face of extreme threats and violence. And I actually feel like this is something that's really important to bring up with Kim Fox and also with Kim Gardner, and also to some degree with Rachel Rollins, which is that they are Black women prosecutors who ran on these reform platforms. And the pushback against them, I actually think that someone really needs to write about this. I've been thinking a lot about it. It bothers me a lot because, okay, these are strong Black women who ran on reform platforms. They got into office and they did a bunch of really important reform work. And for that, what they got was not what their white counterparts got. So when you look at the white people who are in progressive prosecutor positions, so for example, people like Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, they get a lot of pushback. They definitely do, but it's not personal. And with these women, they're getting death threats. People are threatening to kill them, kill their kids. Kim Fox has a security, I think, around the clock for her and her family. And this is a woman with young kids who's adopted kids who, you know, she's vulnerable. And Kim Gardner, they are trying to run her out of St. Louis. And it is absolutely 1,000% racist and misogynistic what's happening to these women. And so I feel like two things are important. One, it's really important to say how amazing they are because they're doing such incredible work. And two, it's really important to call attention to the fact that they're being judged and threatened by the standard that is so unfair and dangerous and upsetting. And so I feel like those are two really important points to make in terms of who you're calling out for praise and also kind of the, what it says about our larger society, what they're up against.
Oh, I forgot one last thing on this topic I wanted to bring up. Have you lost any friends or alienated any people because of the Kamala Harris stuff? Like anyone who was really kind of gung-ho about a woman in the minority winning and thinks like you played a big role in her having to withdraw? I mean, even though there's multiple things, no one can say it's one thing, but I was just wondering if in any like liberal circles you've encountered that.
So I feel like a couple things. One, if you chalk up Kamala Harris having to withdraw to me, then she was not going to win, right? I'm some random law professor in California that no one's ever heard of. Two, I'm sure.
But it did appear in the New York Times, and I don't think you created the talking point, but you can't downplay the way the Times enters a national conversation.
You're right. I can't. But I feel like if you can't rebut me in one op-ed, then that speaks to kind of a bigger problem. But in answer to your question, have like my good friends stopped being friends with me? No. Have people unfollowed me on Twitter? Yes. Are there people who don't want to talk to me anymore? Yes. And I think that, what do I think? I think that's the price that you pay. I mean, this is what I say to my students when I'm training them to be trial lawyers. I say, do not step into the arena unless you are expecting to get hit. Because if you aren't anticipating that, then go do something else. Keep your opinions to yourselves. Talk about it at a dinner party. Don't write it in the New York Times.
I think that's good advice. And that's a good place to end it on. And I wanted to know, are you available to do 45 minutes to an hour on your book? Because we didn't even talk about your book.
I love talking to you guys. It's super fun. We could talk all day.
Okay, great, great. So you know what?
And challenge me more. You can tell me, you can unmute, you can put me in the mute section where you're like, I don't want to talk to this crazy lady anymore. She's so...
No, let me just say this. If I mute, it's because I have three teenagers. So when they get a little loud sometimes, I start to mute so that you don't hear all the crazy.
No, she's saying there. You can mute her.
Oh, mute her. Okay.
You can mute me, but on the on the kid front, you have all my sympathy. If mine were here right now, we wouldn't be able to talk to each other at all. So,
gotcha.
It's been so, I love talking to you guys. It's super interesting. I could talk to you all day.
Awesome. So, we'll end this episode here and join us for the next episode about her book, Rectify, which I read and has a lot of good stuff in it. So, look forward to talking about that.